From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer Susan Orlean is joining us to talk about public libraries, which she loves, always has, really. She wanted to write a book about how libraries work and how they're changing, but she needed a story to make her book work. And then she learned about the fire of the Los Angeles Library in 1986. It destroyed and damaged more than a million books. And that was her way in. We'll be right back.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Susan Orlean's new book, called The Library Book, is a little like her bestseller, The Orchid Thief. At least part of it is. It's about a crime and the eccentric person accused. In this case, not someone who steals rare and valuable flowers, but a man named Harry Peake, accused of setting the largest library fire in the country in 1986. This was the Central Library in Los Angeles. The fire destroyed or damaged more than a million books. So this is part crime story, but the book is also deeply personal for Orlean. It's about her affection and lifelong connection with public libraries, how they function and how they serve as kind of a collective memory for communities. It's also about her mother, how she would take Susan to the library when she was young, and how later, when her mother came to suffer from dementia, she started to see the book as a remembrance she would carry for both of them. Susan Orlean is a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker. She joined us from a studio in Los Angeles, and we began with the branch library of her childhood, the Bertram Woods.
The Bertram Woods branch was about maybe 3/4 of a mile from my house in a suburb of Cleveland. I don't know the year it was built, but I'm guessing it was built sometime in the 50s. It was a classic branch library. It's not very big. It has a children's section and then the general adult section and not lots more than that. To me, it was paradise.
Yeah.
It was it felt like it was as big as the world. And in a sense, that's true of libraries. Their physical space is a little bit less meaningful than the intellectual space that they offer.
Yeah,
I went there a couple times a week with my mom regularly from the time I was very young. To me, those visits were just magical. I loved that library. For a little kid, it was exactly the right size, just big enough to make it feel that I could go off into a separate section away from my mom, mm-hmm. but not so big that it was scary or too big for me to be unsupervised. I really was able to be let on my own when I was quite young because it wasn't a very big space, but it was a wonderful, perfect library for a kid, that's for sure.
Your parents valued books you write about, but and not just because they grew up in the Depression and you could get a book for free, but as you put it in the book, they believed that you would read a book for the experience of reading it, that it wasn't like a trophy or an object that you housed forever. Say a little bit about that. You didn't have a whole lot on your bookshelves growing up, it sounds like.
We didn't have a lot on our bookshelves, and it's something that I realized when I was maybe in high school or college was not the case for everybody, that there were people I knew who had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books on their bookshelves at home, and it was something that I started wanting as I got older. I wanted those books on my shelf. My parents, they loved reading. They loved books. They encouraged reading. they didn't have a great passion for books as objects.
Yeah.
I think they felt that reading a book was a wonderful thing, and it was about the experience of reading the book, and then you were done, and then you read another book, and you didn't build a library, so to speak. You didn't build your own collection of the books you'd read. When I got to college, I began buying books. You know, when you're in college, you have to buy a lot of books. Yeah. And I began buying books that I really loved. And that got me impassioned as a book buyer.
Right.
And I dreamed that my house would simply be lined with bookshelves of hundreds of books. And it became, you know, they were totems to me, really.
Yeah.
They were meaningful as objects.
It's interesting you say that you sloughed off the memory of Bertram Woods for a while. And then you started to wonder what I think a lot of people do. What are libraries for? And this is before, of course, you rediscover a library in Los Angeles, which we'll get to. But what was going on in your mind? You were thinking, I'm not sure what libraries have that much of a purpose anymore. What were you thinking at that moment?
I think that as soon as I began buying books, I suppose I began thinking, you know, well, we just need to go. I mean, if you want a book, you just go buy it.
Yeah.
You don't need to go borrow a book. And that was once I sort of crossed that divide, then it became a matter of thinking, well, why would you need a what is it that libraries are doing? Mm. And it was something that became, I think for a lot of people, it is a point in their life when they may be using the library the least.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're a child, there's lots of programming for children at libraries. So whether you're borrowing books or not, you might be going to story time, or you might be there to explore different books. When you're at that age of having just finished college, when you're no longer going to the library to do research the way everybody does in college, suddenly, you know, because we're all narcissists, you think, well, I'm not using the library, so why would anyone use the library?
Yeah.
And this was not yet the age of the internet, but the question, it's always a perfectly legitimate question to raise, but it became a very relevant question as the internet caused many people to ask that question. What are libraries for if we can access so much information online?
Yeah, yeah. What are they for, Susan, as you reflect back on this time you've been writing about? What are they for? And in essence, I mean, we'll get to some of the particulars and some of the ideas, but what are they for?
Libraries are for many things. For one thing, there is an enormous amount of material in the world's knowledge bank that is not online. And it's something that's important to remember, that we feel as if everything's online. That's not true. There's a lot of material that's not online. But libraries are more than just access to information. They're physical places. They represent a hub of information and knowledge and narrative in a community. More and more, they present a huge amount of programming, and they've become very driven by that mission of providing a place where information is shared and a place where people gather. They represent, in a sense, a community's intellectual and informational center. And that matters. And that's different from Googling who won the World Series in 1949. you know, that's a worthy thing where you could say, I can get that faster at home on my own. now, and I don't need to go to the library to ask a librarian to look that up for me. But that's not the sum total of what we seek as information. And I think having a place that represents the center of a community's intellectual life is a very valuable thing, and one that I believe we're kind of reinvigorating and embracing in a more vigorous way than we have in the last, say, 20 years.
Libraries came back into your life, you say, unexpectedly, is when you moved to Los Angeles. There's this moment, you say, when you took your son to, I think this was the Studio City branch, and you write about how you gasped with a kind of sense of familiarity when you walked in to that library. Talk about Los Angeles sort of being your way back in to libraries.
It's very interesting to have this reignite in a city that nobody associates with libraries. I enjoy the contrarian nature of that, especially because there's so much that I like about surprising people. In fact, someone recently said to me, "How funny to write a book about a library in LA."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, actually, it's not so funny. It's a huge library system." My son was in first grade when we moved to Los Angeles, and he was at the perfect age to be taking him to the library anyway, but he had a school assignment to talk to somebody who worked for the city. I assumed and suggested that he would be interested in interviewing a garbage man. He, in turn, suggested he speak to a librarian, which made me very proud and also made me realize that I had misjudged him horribly. And when I took him to the library to talk and have his little interview with the librarian, I had never been to the branch library. We were very new in town. I mean, had been there maybe a week or two, and he had just started school. Going to that branch and feeling that even though it's not physically very much like the Bertram Woods branch, something about the quality of the place, the sound of it, the smell of it, the distance from my house, all of these qualities that reminded me of these trips to the library with my mother and remembering how marvelous they were and how special and how libraries were so magical in a way that nothing else compared to. It's really, I mean, I love bookstores too, but a library has a magic that's quite different from a bookstore. It has a breadth of material that a bookstore isn't going to have. And the fact that the books are just there and you can take them is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And this experience taking my son made me really awaken something that had been dormant for a long time. And that was that feeling of wonder and delight in a library. That, in turn, made me really curious about what the elements were that made libraries so special, that I could walk in and have that kind of experience of feeling that this was the center, in many ways, of my connection to my mom, that these trips were that special as compared to our trips together anywhere else. I spent so much time with my mom growing up. But it was going to the library that felt especially enchanted.
So the idea of writing a book about libraries, I guess if you're starting to think about this, you're probably wondering, well, what am I going to say? Is this an entire book? Is this a, I don't know how you were thinking about it exactly, but you've talked about kind of resisting the idea a little bit, worrying that maybe it's kind of formless. And then was it the fire that helped you, that led you into thinking maybe I can write about this? Is that right?
Yes, very much. You know, I'll confess that before I took my son to the library and had this sort of Proustian moment of feeling reconnected with my past, it had crossed my mind that writing about the life of a library would be very interesting. And I dismissed it because it did feel shapeless. I thought it was a very worthwhile subject, but it didn't feel that it had a narrative drive that would hold it together as a book sufficiently. So I just shelved it in the back of my head, along with other ideas that come and go and strike me as interesting. When I learned about the fire, I decided immediately that I was going to write this book, because suddenly there was this dramatic event that was uniquely particular to libraries, because libraries burning are something that's happened throughout history, and it's full of meaning and portent and emotion. And in this case, I was fascinated to figure out what happened here?
Yeah.
Why had I never heard about this dramatic and cataclysmic event? Who did it? Why did they do it? And how did their library recover? I mean, it became so dramatic and fascinating that it felt like a perfect way in to this other story, which was the more general story of why do we feel so connected to libraries? What do they do? How do they fit in our lives? And why do we feel so emotional about them?
There's a moment you write about in the book where you learn about the fire. And I have to say, it's a really good story. It's when someone who runs the Library Foundation of Los Angeles is giving you this tour of the Central Library in Los Angeles. And they stop for a moment and they pick up a book and they smell it. Would you tell this moment, because this was kind of a revelation for you?
It absolutely was. We were walking through the library, and the head of the foundation, a man named Ken Brecker, was telling me all about the library. And it was very, very lively. I was excited because there were so many wonderful stories about the library's history, about people who had worked there, and you know, I was very excited, just thinking, wow, this is an amazing place with an incredible history. We were in the fiction section and stopped for a moment. He pulled a book off the shelf and held it up to his face and then took a deep whiff and just inhaled deeply. And I was a little awkward and thought, what do I do now? Do I pull a book off the shelf and smell it? I mean, what are we supposed to do?
Yeah.
And what is he doing? And who smells books like that? It was a very strange moment. Then he said, "You can still smell the smoke in some of them." I said, "I had no idea that they let people smoke in the library." He said, no, smoke from the fire. I said, what fire? And he said, oh, the big fire in 1986. And I said, what fire in 1986? He said, you know, the big fire, it shut the library for 7 years. And my jaw dropped. And I said, tell me more. And in the meantime, we had moved on and we were in another section of the library. And he was telling me all about other aspects of the library. And I just kept thinking, fire in 1986 that shut the library down? What is this all about? The minute I got home, I started frantically researching to find out some of the details, and in that moment decided that I was going to write a book about it.
The fire, of course, April 29th, 1986. You were living in New York at the time, and you mentioned how it was hard for you to imagine not knowing about something like this, loving as you do books. But talk a little bit about what was competing for the attention. I mean, it didn't really even make it into the New York Times until, I think, the next a day or two later, and it was buried on A14 or something like that. But there was a lot going on at in 1986 in April.
There certainly was. And yeah, I was flabbergasted that there wasn't coverage of this, especially in New York City, which is the center of the publishing world. And certainly there would be an interest in a fire of this size in a city as big as Los Angeles. I just was puzzled. When I pulled up the New York Times from that day, I suddenly understood why I hadn't heard about it. The headline in the New York Times was a banner saying something to the effect of Soviets deny meltdown at Chernobyl nuclear plant. And most of the paper was devoted, most of the A section of the paper was devoted to disaster at Chernobyl, which at the time that it occurred, and I quickly remembered all of the anxiety at that time, no one knew what was going to happen, whether there was going to be a global catastrophe as a result of this meltdown. It was... To say it was a distraction seems to trivialize it. It was a fixation, and it was international fixation. People were really frightened. That dominated the news, frankly, not only for the next day or two, but for quite some time. So the library fire was written about with... you know, certainly attention was paid, but it was tucked back, as you say, in A14 in the back of the A section with a few follow-up stories about what it was going to mean to not have a library. But the world's attention was fixated on Chernobyl.
Yeah. Of course, it was devastating, and I wanted to ask you about the way you wrote about the fire. I think you've described it as you had in your mind the idea of some great predator on the prowl. Would you just talk a little bit about that? Because this section where you write about just the nature of that kind of fire with all of that fuel there and the kind of perfect moment of combustion, the sense of heat and destruction is remarkable, I think.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was, you know, I was working from a couple of fantastic primary sources, chief among them the incident report from the fire department that really detailed moment to moment what was going on with the fire itself, where it was moving, where it was spreading, and the movement of the firefighters, including just very detailed information about which equipment was being used, what crew was doing what action to try to attack the fire. So I had a roadmap of what was going on. I also had from an insurance report that was equally detailed, talking about the movement of the fire and the effort to put it out. I then interviewed a lot of firefighters who were there, and that gave me an anecdotal sense of what it was like to be in a fire that was so stupendously hot. I mean, it ended up rising to 2,500 degrees inside, and it burned for 7.5 hours. I wanted to inhabit the moment, so to speak. And it's not something I do that often in my writing. I am more comfortable acknowledging the distance between me and the events that I'm writing about. But in this case, it felt necessary. And I wanted to bring to life this sense of fire it was succeeding for 7.5 hours to survive, and that it was just eating its way through the library, because that's what it seemed like from the accounts that I had from the firefighters, that this was this raging beast that they were trying to chase down, and it was eluding them, and it kept finding new ways to spread through the building and reach more books to burn up.
Yeah.
And the books were being consumed entirely, which was, you know, often fire will be burning in a space that has metal and different materials that aren't as combustible, but a library is basically all things that burn and burn completely.
Yeah.
So the fire was just eating book after book after book. And I wanted to try to bring the ferocity of the fire to life for the reader.
Susan Orlean, she's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her new book is called The Library Book. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer Susan Orlean is joining us to talk about public libraries. She's written a book about how libraries work, how they function, how they're changing. It's also about the fire of the Los Angeles Public Library in 1986 that destroyed or damaged more than 1 million books. Her book is called The Library Book. Let's talk about the man accused of starting this Los Angeles library fire, Harry Peek. One of the things that you've talked about is how you're interested in places where people go to reinvent themselves, and how California in a lot of ways is ideal. I think a lot of people, of course, know the book The Orchid Thief and the character John LaRoche. Do you see any connections between LaRoche, the orchid thief, and Harry Peek, the person accused of starting this fire?
Absolutely. And they're very, very different people. And I wouldn't, I want to make it plain that that I see them as very distinct. But sure, they share in common a lot of qualities that I find very interesting. Both of them had this desire to make their lives larger, mm-hmm, and to dramatize and amplify who they were and are. And since one of them is still alive, John LaRoche, mm-hmm, and thriving, and Harry Peek is not alive any longer, so I'm kind of mixed verb tenses here. But
yeah,
I think that impulse to create a mythic version of yourself is something that they shared very much, and a kind of storyteller's passion
yeah
for inventing themselves, which is a quality that I guess you could also say reflects in an interesting way on the very nature of being a writer, since we're also trying to tell tales, although in my case I'm trying to tell true stories and I'm not embroidering on what I find to be the truth.
Yeah.
But the nature, this sort of impulse to create a story about who you are, was something that Harry Peake absolutely did. And, you know, the difference is he tended to tell stories about himself that were entirely invented, whereas LaRoche actually lived the inventions. And and rather than just saying that he was doing these rather extraordinary things, he would just do them and then, you know, make this dramatic life for himself out of his wild passions. So they struck me as having a lot in common. And Harry, in his own way, was a bit of a victim of the moment. And I won't go into detail, only because there's a certain element of suspense in the story, and rather than telling you everything that happened to him, he, you know, his life unfolded in a way that had a lot to do with the moment in time in which he was living.
You mentioned people have been burning libraries for nearly as long as they've been building libraries. A Chinese emperor was one of the first book burners. You write about that. There's the Library of Alexandria in Egypt, of course. During the Inquisition, you talk about they had these book burning festivals, and it gets us to the Nazis, of course, burned about 100 million books, you talk about. And I wanted to – there's something that you said that it was interesting, this idea of burning books. Like, what's the impulse there? But also the effect that it had on – certainly the Nazis on Jews, excruciating for the Jews, as you say, people of the book, of course, here. And you talked about how you'd be really curious to know that – Of a culture in which books were burned and where there wasn't also connected to it in some way a mass extermination of people. And I wanted to get you talking about that, like what the connection might be. Like, what is the impulse to burn books and what might be the connection for these mass exterminations?
It is a really disturbing, haunting notion. And this was something that it occurred to me very recently, and I didn't explicitly address it in the book, but I kind of doubt that you can think of a culture in which books were burned where at some point people weren't executed.
Yeah.
You know, that there seems to be a connection that's very deep. What's interesting to me is that burning books, you know, 2,000 years ago, when there were few and far between, it actually rid the world of a certain amount of knowledge. If you burned a book and it was the only copy, then there went that.
Yeah.
As we entered a you know, post Gutenberg press, when books were produced in large quantities, burning books becomes entirely symbolic. There, it is not, you are not removing from the world this unit of knowledge. You're just making a symbolic gesture. And that gesture is one of erasure, of saying these thoughts are being erased from the world's memory. The Nazis were an example of this to the extreme, which is, this was a way of sort of foreshadowing the removal of people from the world's memory. And there's no strategic value in burning a library. The idea that the Nazis had a commando crew that were assigned the task of library burning, it's interesting because you think, well, that's manpower that you're devoting to something that isn't actually of strategic value. It's only a symbolic value, and that value is profound. If I saw someone burning copies of my books, even though I know there are more of them, it would have that effect on me.
Yeah.
There is a connection that we have to books that's unique. And I think it's because it's not removed from the human experience. It is the human experience. Books contain information and knowledge and narratives and fantasies and the interior of someone's mind. That's what a book is. It's just a vehicle for delivering this, that it contains the human spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So burning books is meant to cause injury to this human spirit, to cause it to feel vulnerable and to suggest that it can be made to disappear. Because in practical terms, it isn't removing those thoughts from the world, but it's a symbolic gesture of saying, we will remove you from the world. And it had a very profound effect on people.
Yeah.
And I can absolutely understand it. I would feel if we were in a war and all the books by American authors were being burned, I think Americans would be horrified. And on a level that is, it's not on a rational level. It's on a deep spiritual level where you feel that it's some statement of oppression and more than oppression, it's a way of saying you will be forgotten. You are going to be erased from the world. And I think that there's no statement that can feel more devastating than that idea that a culture and a people could be erased. And I think that makes sense when you think of how the Nazis looked to erase entire peoples. Burning their books was just a way of sort of foreshadowing the idea of removing these people from the world population.
And also, I thought about the idea of burning a book as being a way of depriving people of just the ability to speak their mind. I mean, you tell the story of Ray Bradbury's book, Fahrenheit 451, how it began as this story, and then he sets it aside. And it really wasn't until he saw a speech by Senator Joseph McCarthy that he tried to finish it, that he was connecting it to something really present in the moment, it seems. Is that what was going on?
Absolutely. And he was addressing a lot of other concerns he had at the time about the world being suddenly swept up with television and, you know, the books were somehow going to be lost in this new era. But I think that the impulse that drove him to finish the book was this concern that censorship and fear of speaking out was going to consume us, and that knowledge would be lost, storytelling would be lost, the freedom to express yourself would be lost. I just reread it while I was working on the book, and it's remarkably apt for any moment in history. But I think at that moment, with McCarthyism and the fear that it brought and the sense that you had to hide, which is a kind of inverse of what books do, which is you're making a statement and being heard and seen. broadly. This was a moment when the idea of what books contain, which is this free expression, was being threatened. Mm. And it's interesting that in Fahrenheit 451, the people who eventually the firefighter who has secretly been saving books and has fled and joins this band of outcasts, and they are – the printed word is no longer available, but they have memorized books and are chanting them and reciting them so that they can be remembered, because really books just exist as a tool to deliver what would be an oral tradition, that that they become the method of distributing stories that might have in an earlier era been just told orally.
Yeah. It's also interesting that the title for Bradbury's book comes from the chief of the Los Angeles Fire Department. And it raises – there's another – element in your book that you write about this, you know, the principles of arson investigation, how in some ways they might be more myth than reality. I mean, I wanted you to say a little bit about this, that the questions of how we know where a fire starts, what we can say about it, what we can even say definitively right now about what actually happened in Los Angeles. Say something about this part. I thought this was really interesting too.
Well, it fascinated me. Of course, I knew nothing about arson or arson investigation before I started the story. I knew just from what I could surmise and whatever I've read in the past about different crimes is that it is a very difficult crime to investigate. What I didn't know and what I found fascinating is that much of the methodology of investigating fires is, in a sense, sort of folktale. And no – firefighters and fire investigators aren't, as far as I can tell, intentionally doing a bad job. That's not it at all.
Yeah.
It's that over the years, certain assumptions about how to study fire have been passed along from one generation of firefighters to the next and arson investigators to the next, and that only – relatively recently has anybody said, wait, let's stop and look at this and figure out how is it that we've been investigating? Have we ever actually applied science to this and analyzed it and understood whether these assumptions about how to study a fire are actually supportable with science and not just that, well, this is the way we've always done it, and so we continue to do it this way. And it's as a result, there have been some real significant changes in how fire is being investigated, but it also has meant that if you look back at a lot of the convictions of arson that have happened, quite a few of them need to be reanalyzed,
yeah,
and examined with the new scientific methodology, not the long-held assumptions, but the ones that are now provable scientifically.
I want to come back to the question of the future of libraries, because you mentioned this essay written in, I think it was 1871, where a visitor to a library imagined what it would be like in the future, and they conceived of it as all of this information being, I think as they put it, pressed into the object the size of a suitcase, which is like, that's kind of right. I mean, that's where we are. And so When you talked to the librarians that you talked to for the book, what were they saying about the future? Because it seems like a lot of them sounded upbeat. And as you were saying earlier, it sounds like they have a reason to be optimistic. I mean, I loved this factoid you put in the book, that public libraries outnumber McDonald's. That's nice to know. And it surprised me that libraries are growing more popular with people under 30. That's nice to know, too.
Yes. And I think that that's one of the healthiest signs. You know, I think to begin with, saying that librarians are optimistic doesn't mean that they're saying that libraries will remain the way they've always been.
Yeah.
Libraries are evolving. They're changing dramatically. So many people come to the library to use the computers or to get on the Wi-Fi. I mean, that alone is obviously something that didn't even exist 20 years ago. Mm. So they are evolving. But what's been encouraging is, first of all, they seem to be making good decisions about how to evolve. And secondly, the appeal to people younger than 30 is a great sign. And those are the people for whom a place to work is an incredibly important part of their daily life, because increasingly people of that age are not working in offices. They're independent contractors who, as a result, are either working at home or they're working in a coffee shop or in a co-working space. And libraries represent a wonderful addition to that set of choices. As a place to work and a place to be around other people if you don't want to work at home and be essentially isolated. And in part, a big attraction is, well, it's nice to be out and be around other people and enjoy the sense of being part of a community, of society. And that, I believe, is driving a lot of the appreciation of libraries as open spaces like that.
I wanted to come back finally to the story you tell about being with your mom, going to the library with her, like that kind of ritual you had where you're coming back from the library and you both have these books and you're making this plan about which one you're going to read first and how you're going to do it and how you can get them all finished and read before, you know, they're due. And it made me think about something you said about libraries being our collective brain, because of course your mother began to suffer from dementia, and you write that just as you were discovering your memories, your mother was losing hers. And in some ways, this rediscovery of libraries for you became, I think you put it, it was a, became a remembrance for both of you. Would you say something about that finally?
It was certainly an unexpected turn in the course of working on the book, because it began in a way with, I mean, my drive to do this book was certainly triggered by those memories of the trips with my mother and my wish to savor those and to understand why they were so special. It dawned on me as I began working on the book that, of course, this was a very meta exploration, because libraries are essentially a big tool for remembering. And it is remembering knowledge, information, stories, dreams, fantasies. That's what they do. I mean, books preserve and remember for us everything that a culture remembers. To have my mother losing her memory as I was writing this book was a deep wound for me, and also strangely made this whole idea of remembering and committing on a page something that would otherwise be truly evanescent. And it made the writing of this book feel kind of urgent to me to remember those trips, and because they were so defining in terms of my relationship with my mom and so wonderful. And I realized that as I was writing this, that she couldn't remember those anymore, and that she never would, and that they were gone for her, except that I could put them on a page and save them forever. I mean, even at a point where I won't remember them, or I'm not here on Earth anymore, they're permanent, and that made me appreciate part of the marvel of books and of libraries is that ability to remember forever.
Susan Orlean. Her new book is called The Library Book. She joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.